You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Hundreds of men from five Muslim countries continue to be detained by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in Los Angeles after voluntarily coming in for registration as mandated by new immigration guidelines. About 4,000 Iranian Americans demonstrated in front of the Westwood Federal Building in Los Angeles yesterday to protest the way their friends and family have been mistreated at the hands of federal authorities. Christopher Sprinkle reports from Los Angeles.
I was born in Iran. I've been here for 25 years. I'm a U.S. citizen. I came here for those who were detained unlawfully and unjustly.
I was detained.
You were detained?
Yes, I was detained for 2 days.
What charges?
Still don't know. I still don't know why.
How much did they charge you to get out?
Oh, well, that was a bailout for $1,500 minimum bailout. So most of us, we didn't have any criminal record. So no criminal record, $1,500.
So there's a minimum that we detain you for no criminal offense, but we charge you $1,500.
Yes. I didn't deserve to be chained and handcuffed. I never been handcuffed in my life.
This is not right. Law has to have a due process. And they should be judged and treated as a citizen, just like we are in a democratic country. United States is supposed to stand for a democratic country. And we are here because there's democracy in this country. And now we're starting to fear that we might be treated like Nazis. We keep a good community. In 20 years that we've been here, we have proved that we are intelligent people, we are active in the community, and we try to help save the world from terrorism, from peoples like Taliban, and hostile groups. And as you can see, everybody's here. They're here to show that we are united and against terrorism.
My name is Parvin, P-A-R-V-I-N. It's hard to talk about it. My husband was in jail from Friday at 6 o'clock. He went to INS, and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they put him in jail, in INS jail. And then at 9:30, they took him to the Lancaster jail, and they took him until Monday. And his bail was for $1,500. I went there in the morning, very early, at 6 o'clock in the morning, Monday. And it took us until 1:30 in the afternoon to post the bail and waiting. They told me they're gonna release him at between 4 to 6. And I drive in the rain to the Lancaster, and they released them at 9:44 in the night. And the INS officer, he was so rude. He treated him as a terrorist, and he put them handkerchief. How do you say? Yeah, handcuff. And my problem is, I was not there. But even when I'm thinking about it, it's killing me, because they took him in front of everybody like a criminal. But we didn't do anything wrong. But they treat him like a criminal. I don't know what can I say to my kids.
Did they charge him for anything when they took him in? Did they have any reason?
No reason, because they told him, why you didn't renew your visa. But in that time, there were law by government that there is a limit to go and do something for it. And we did it. Before the due date, we did it. But the INS officer, he didn't even listen to him. He didn't let him to talk. To explain. And you know, we were refugee politic in France, and we lived there for 11 years, and we came here. We never treated like that. And you know, the INS officer, he was laughing at my husband, and he told him, oh, you're so lucky, because when we're gonna deport you, you are going to France, you are not going to Iran. And when he went to the jail, they told them, they were too many people. They were doctor, engineer. My husband is photographer. They told them, we don't care what did you do. You are criminal now. And we are treat you as a criminal. And they did. And they did. In the nighttime, it was very, very cold in Lancaster. They give them only one sheet, nothing. And they really treat them as a criminal. But they didn't insult them. I'm telling you the truth. But INS officers, they were so rude to them.
Did your husband say how many people were in the Lancaster jail with him?
In this special place where he lived for three days, it was around 60, 70 people. And they were mostly Iranian, but they were from Syria. One gentleman from England, one from Canada, one from Israel, and the other from Armenia. Yeah. That was, I believe I never forget that. This insult, I never, ever, ever, I can forget. I can do that.
And also, the Iranian society really appreciated for all those support you, all those media doing for Iranian people, because we don't have anybody to just, support us. And we want, the only reason everybody is here, we just want to know, we leave everything behind, come to this country to get us right. That's only thing we're asking. We are all human beings. We are all the same. We are not different than anybody else. We are all under the same law in this country. That's what we wanted. The law support us. That's all everybody's here for. Thank you.
Thanks to Peace Watch producer Dan Pavlish of Pacifica Station KPFK for that segment. The practice of public diplomacy has evolved and adapted to meet the challenges of the post-911 environment and to support the war on terrorism. That's according to Charlotte Beers, Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, in her address at the National Press Club yesterday. Reem Kathuta, Pacifica's Peace Watch producer for WPFW in Washington, has more in this report.
We watched with awe today the United States manipulate the remarks of Hans Blix regarding the documents delivered by Iraq to the UN arms inspectors. They described the gaps in the Iraqi document as a material breach, while Blix said that it was a promising debut. Yesterday, hosted by the State Department at Washington, Charlotte Beers, Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, made a PowerPoint presentation on her department's information management in what it calls recent and forthcoming public diplomacy initiatives, particularly vis-à-vis Arab and Muslim audiences of all ages.
We're going to publish an Arabic youth magazine. This is a really good way to talk to the young people about health, about possibilities, about learning. And we have, hopefully, a partnership with Sesame Street. We have been dazzled by the work they did in Egypt. Their Sesame Street Alan Simsim character is running there. They use local producers. The children are glued to the set. They're learning English.
With fascinating candor, Beers reviewed how the USA's public diplomacy uses every trick in the book of public relations and marketing to manage national and international information related to USA's domestic and foreign policy since it declared its endless war on terrorism after 9/11. Beers relays the success of stifling dissent.
The reach of our messages has now become an absolutely burning issue. I think it's impressive that we are able to get out any messages from any of the government officials, not just State Department, on the same day they're delivered in 30 languages, so it's fast and it's believable.
Of course, the target now is managing information around Iraq. There are a couple of difficult points out there.
What's really a very impressive point here is the president's own words. I hope the good people of Iraq will remember our history. America has never sought to dominate, never sought to conquer. We have, in fact, sought to liberate and free. Our desire is to help Iraqi citizens find the blessings of liberty within their own culture and their own traditions.
Yourself!
Against the many voices that we hear in the world, some of which we heard here, and we always preserve the right for such interruptions to take place in our country. I should point out to those young women that in Iraq they wouldn't have stood a chance of walking out freely.
Police intercepted the protesters in the press club lobby. Later that day, Wayne Madsen, the Washington Bureau Chief of Intelligence Online, joined us at WPFW's offices to comment on Beer's presentation.
After months of delays, the Undersecretary of State for International Public Diplomacy, Charlotte Beers, finally held a product unveiling slash press conference on her International Information Programs Bureau within the State Department. Beers, a former Madison Avenue advertising executive who once sold toothpaste and deodorant in mass marketing campaigns, was named by President Bush to sell America abroad. This comes at a time when public opinion polls are showing much of the world having negative views of the United States. Through the production of television programs and commercials, radio stations like Radio Sawa that broadcast mostly music interspersed with pro-U.S. news stories to the Arab region, glossy booklets and magazine advertisements, Beer's propaganda bureau is attempting to sway international public opinion over to the U.S. way of thinking. No age group is immune. In Cairo, Beer's bureau has partnered with the local Sesame Street production to aim pro-American messages to Arab children. The ties between U.S. propaganda and pop culture do not end with Sesame Street. Beer's told the National Press Club audience that her agenda and that of Defense Secretary Rumsfeld are the same. Telling the truth always. The Defense Department, through a unit within Beer's organization called the International Military Information Group, works with DC Comics to produce Superman and Spider-Man comic books in other languages that are aimed at teens. For adult audiences, State's International Information Programs Bureau cleverly places ads on foreign television networks that are sometimes picked up by CNN. Such was the case with an ad on Indonesian TV that featured young Indonesian Muslims explaining how surprised they were to know that American Muslims lived in peace and security without even a hint of xenophobia or racism. That same ad was rebroadcast by CNN's Jakarta bureau chief. We must remember how propaganda campaigns have been used to deceive the American people in the past. During Desert Shield, Bush's father's campaign against Iraq, the U.S. and the world were treated to stories about Kuwaiti babies being pulled out of incubators by invading Iraqi troops. The source for this story was a young Kuwaiti woman, who also happened to be the daughter of Kuwait's ambassador to the United States, and who, incidentally, had not been in Kuwait during the invasion. President George H.W. Bush consistently referred to the Iraqis yanking babies from incubators. This story was false, but it was used to help convince Congress and the American people to support the war effort. Today, the target is again Iraq, and Charlotte Beers is working on ways to conduct a pro-war perception management campaign. And for added measure, former Reagan National Security Advisor and convicted Iran-Contra criminal Admiral John Poindexter is developing a total information awareness program to identify, interdict, and block Internet content deemed to be unfavorable to U.S. interests. The marriage of U.S. State Department propaganda and Defense Department disinformation portends an ominous future for a free and open press. Last week, the Defense Department floated an unconfirmed intelligence report that Iraq had provided deadly VX nerve gas to al-Qaeda. The gas was said to have been given to an anti-Saddam Kurdish group called Ansar al-Islam. Without bothering to consider that if such a transfer were made, it would have been done within the U.S.-protected Kurdish northern no-fly zone and involved transport through U.S. ally Turkey, the U.S. media simply swallowed the story, hook, line, and sinker. If Charlotte Beers has her way, the U.S. and the world will be swallowing many more stories than that.
Madsen has worked in the U.S. intelligence for the National Security Agency for a number of years under the Reagan administration, giving him a unique access and angle to USA's administration's information management. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Kathoda.
Thanks to Tom Gomez of WBIX for help on that segment.
I've traveled round the country and I'll tell you what I've seen. A million yellow ribbons and I've wondered what they mean. It's love and hope and sympathy for those who've gone to fight. Still I know that none of these can make the killing right. When we see two children fighting, don't we try to come between? We get them both to talk instead of acting rough and mean. We give them love and limits, say, now try to get along. Then we tell them it's all right to kill, to prove that killing's wrong. Sometimes that yellow ribbon tries to make me feel ashamed. It tells me I'm a traitor, that somehow it's me to blame. But I can't hide behind it just to prove that I belong. And I won't be an accomplice to things I know are wrong. But I'd wear a yellow ribbon for the peace that's in my heart. I'd wear it for the loved ones who should never have to part. I'd wear it for the wasted lives, no matter friend or foe. And I'd wear it for the children if they never had to go. Yes, I've seen the yellow ribbons hanging up all over town, but I don't think they'll ever buy the peace we've never found. The guns will all be silent and the battle flags all furled when we tie a yellow ribbon round the world. The guns will all be silent and the battle flags all furled when we tie a yellow ribbon round the world.
Utah Phillips, Yellow Ribbon. As the U.S. mobilizes for a new war against Iraq, the stream of refugees from the last war with Afghanistan continue to flow. And ironically, they're traveling very close to the Iraqi border. From Istanbul, Khalid Sidmohan reports on Turkey's new community of Afghan refugees.
The first Afghan refugees came to Turkey in the mid-80s during the war between Afghanistan and the USSR. The majority settled in Zeynburnu, a poor neighborhood located in the west of Istanbul. But as the wars followed one after another, the flow of refugees kept growing, until it reached 60,000 Afghans. Most of Afghan refugees see Istanbul as a staging ground on their way to Western Europe. Sundar is 27. He fled Afghanistan when the famous and brutal General Abdul Rashid Dostum took power in his region in the mid-90s. The Taliban ousted General Dostum, but the U.S. military put Dostum in power again when it bombed the Taliban out of Afghanistan last fall. As the majority of his fellow refugees, Sundar fled Afghanistan through Pakistan, Iran, and eventually Turkey, where he wasn't expecting to stay so long. But he's been stuck in Istanbul for more than 5 years. In a tea shop, he explains why he wants to go to Europe.
I know that up there I will have everything necessary to start a normal life, like having a regular job. And at the same time, I know I'll be able to save money for the family back in the country. Here in Turkey, I make less than $150 per month, which isn't even enough for me to survive. So how can I send anything to Afghanistan?
Turkey's recent economic crisis doesn't help. Hamid is 26 years old. He also comes from Mazar-i Sharif. He works as a mechanic 11 hours a day, 6 days a week, for less than $150 per month. But for the moment, he doesn't complain about his working conditions because he's been out of work for more than 2 weeks. He tells the difficulties of life in Turkey.
I would like to settle, but for the 2.5 years I've lived here, I have nothing, no identity card, not a single paper to show, if necessary. When I leave my home in the morning, I always fear being arrested and deported to the Iranian border.
Under Turkish law, Afghan refugees like Hamid don't exist officially, so they can be deported at any time. Sardar explains what happens when the police arrest them.
Two months ago, two unidentified dead bodies were found in Zeynburnu. The police decided then to arrest and jail 150 Afghanis. They were deported to the closest mountains and the Iranian border, where they were threatened with death if they tried to come back. And they found the same reception committee on the other side of the border. So they hung around in the mountains. We heard that some of them died in the cold. Since then, we haven't had any news from those people. I had two friends among them, and their parents keep calling me from Afghanistan to know what happened to their children. What should I tell them?
Omar is a 45-year-old Afghan man who settled in Istanbul 15 years ago. Even if he doesn't love Istanbul, he will not go back home even if the war is over. We're having a tea in his video shop where all the community stop at least once a week to rent an Indian or an old Afghani movie.
I would love to go back to Afghanistan, but all I ever had, I lost. All that is left for me is this little video shop with which I could feed my family. What can I do in Afghanistan? There's no jobs, no future. I'd really love to return there, but I have nothing to do in Afghanistan, and there's no employment. The only difference I can see is they got rid of the Taliban. Otherwise, nothing's changed. People are still hungry. There aren't any jobs. The economy is down. People are still suffering from the consequences of the war. No, for me, nothing has changed. The only point on which we respect the new government is that it maintains the peace, which might help the country to get progressively out of the crisis.
On the midway of their trip, these young people, penniless, cannot afford a smuggler to take them to Europe. Smugglers who charge $2,500 for a crossing, which sometimes ends with death at the bottom of the sea. But they say they are determined not to go home until they have saved enough money to support their families. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Khaled Sidmohand in Istanbul.
Finally tonight, we present these collages from Amelia Gonzalez and the volunteers in Pacifica Station KPFA's apprenticeship program. First, the sounds of war, followed by some precious sounds of peace.
What is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
You know nothing but no war.
Everybody knows war. Who? Yeah. What it is it good for? Absolutely nothing.
Tell us a little bit about the war, man.
Well, there's only one thing I can say about
the war zone. Sex will be loose in a couple of minutes. Put the gun inside your goose.
Daddy is coming back, though. Mrs. Mills, our father's fighting in a war and...
I figured why should just the poor kids go off to war and the rich kids always get away with it?
Oh, I see. What we got here is a crusader. Yeah.
Got a call one late night from my nigga Thor telling me buckshot, get ready, prepare for war.
You ready for war?
Once that first bullet goes past your head, politics and all that, they just comes right out the window.
I just want to do it right tonight.
Just watch your corner. All your men back here alive.
What? When's Daddy coming home?
When the war's over.
Why did he go to war? I mean, nobody's done anything bad to us.
What happened today is just the beginning. We're gonna lose this war.
Come on. You really think so? Us?
We've been kicking other people's asses for so long, I figure it's time we got ours kicked.
Here's a story about
peace!
Yo, what happened to peace? Peace.
Wake up, everybody. No more screaming in bed. No more backwards thinking. Time for thinking ahead.
Why do people think just because we speak peace, we can't throw no joints?
I don't know.
You are now about to witness the strength of
peace
knowledge.
Had to shut them down, bound by a peace treaty.
We don't need nobody. We don't need no war. We don't need no dying. It's peace we're living for.
We bring the peace of course.
Prince of Peace, won't you hear our plea? Ring your bells of peace. That loving never
sees. So I'm reading the graffiti. The walls say peace treaty.
The last P well, that's not that simple, huh?
Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
The sounds of War and Peace, brought to us by the KPFA Apprenticeship Program under the direction of Amelia Gonzalez. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Hermes Rivera of UN Radio, Tom Gomez, and Dora Ruse. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We'd love to hear your comments and thoughts about the show. You can send us your feedback at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.